Right. What is the date? This is Thursday, January 23rd. Urban Renewal Agency, DAB. We'll start with roll call. Joshua King.
Present.
Aaron Turpinning, I'm here. Hillary Holman Kidd.
Present.
Did I say it right?
Yes.
Welcome. Vincenzo Maduri, not here yet. Tyson Giza.
Giza, yes.
Brad Compton.
Here.
Scott McLeod.
Here.
Linda Nishioka.
Here.
Dana Buchtamine.
Yes, us.
Lori Miller.
Here.
All right. Did everybody have a chance to look at the agenda? Any comments or questions? Need a motion to approve it?
I'm only going to approve the agenda. Look longer.
I second.
All right, moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. And the minutes from December?
I move that we approve the minutes from December.
Thank you.
I second that.
Moved and seconded. And all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And opposed? Thank you. Before we move on, I just want to, we have a new member here. So, Hillary, first we'll go around the table and just introduce ourselves and maybe say, just each person just briefly say, you know, why you're here. Why do you care about downtown? So, I'll start. Aaron Turpinning, I work at CB2 Architects. Born and raised here in Salem, and just live just north of here near downtown and love downtown and want to see it thrive and do whatever I can to help.
Linda Nishioka, downtown property owner, and I've been here 21 years and again love Salem and want the downtown to be loved by many.
Oh, tell her what you have underway.
Oh, I have the Nishioka building is the project that's going on. Downtown, the building project that's going on with the big crane.
Big crane.
The 148 micro units.
The micro units.
At state,
okay.
And commercial.
Excellent.
Yes, exactly. Yep. I'm Tyson Giza, and this is my second official meeting as a advisory board member. I work for Pal Van's Valuation, and we do commercial appraisals throughout the Willamette Valley, but we do a lot of work in downtown. My office is in downtown, and I'm also born and raised here in Salem, and excited to see how far downtown has come since I've been here and where it's headed. So.
Yeah, tell us about yourself.
I'm Hillary Holman Kidd. I'm here representing WOO, but I also have I am also a born and raised Salemite, so I have also deep interest in seeing the downtown area thrive, and I currently live in Salem, so, but being here representing WOO, we did just purchase a Vic building, and we're in the midst of renovations, and we will have classes starting there in fall, end of September, and we are very excited to be a part of the community and assist in however we can in the community development and economic development in the area.
No big cranes?
Not yet.
Glad to have you here.
Welcome. Does everybody know where the Vic building is?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm Dana Buchtamine, the Salem Center Mall. I've started my 16th year working in Salem, all of which have been at the shopping center. I also have been on the DAB for most of those years, but not all of them. And also, go down Salem in the past and Salem Main Street Association now. Always vested interest in doing that as a downtown as well.
Brad Compton, I work down at Pioneer Trust Bank downtown, born and raised here. Fourth generation of my family involved in that building and managed a lot of property in downtown. Care deeply about the success, economic health, vibrancy of downtown.
Scott McLeod, my family, we have the Gray Building, which we've renovated, and we build generations deep like the Comptons, and so very interested in the progress of the downtown area.
And I eat donuts as a building.
Yeah, we all do. Mark appreciates.
You need to set the location, the line's too long.
I'm Claire, and I manage the Equitable Center. The owners that own the Equitable Center have invested in Salem for 40 years. I spend all my life there, you know, pretty much Monday through Friday, so I'm invested in seeing Salem be fabulous. Plus, when I have family members come out from out of town, it'd be nice to have them be able to go somewhere and see a play and go to a nice dinner, and so I would like to, you know, see that for our downtown.
My name is Josh Kay. I moved into downtown Salem about 6 months ago on State Street. I guess I've lived in Salem all my life, and I guess about downtown, I just want to see it reach its full potential, and I feel like we're close. That's it.
Sheree Wargren, and I get the pleasure of staffing this board and working with all of you, and as I shared with you during your orientation, this is a great board to be a part of, and we're so happy that you're here too. And you.
Yeah, let the record show that Vincenzo is here.
Hello. I'm Vincenzo Maduri. I'm the founding artistic director of Enlightened Theatrics at Salem's Historic Grand Theater downtown. And I was born and raised here, went to school in North Carolina, and lived in New York, and came home to start Enlightened Theatrics to provide for the community.
When's Marcos over?
Huh?
Yeah.
Very soon.
Okay.
Very, 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 very soon.
Maybe for Valentine's Day?
But things are moving. Things are moving.
And one more small thing to note. I just wanted to thank Dana for being here, because he's here out of the goodness of his heart, even though he's beyond his... We're glad to have you here.
Yes. Thank you.
What a great role.
Makes me a
fellow, GAB fellow.
That's right.
All right, thanks. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And we're excited to have Western Oregon.
Exactly.
Have a presence.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, excited.
Okay, public comment. Anyone wishing to address the board on something other than what's on the agenda?
I presume that homelessness is not on the agenda, but somewhat I've been trying to review this to see how that fits in.
I'd say...
I would suggest we take comments now.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead. And if you'd like to address us...
Sure. Yeah. We allow 2 minutes for comment?
I was... I'm off the agenda.
Can you give us your name for
my name is Jean Hender, and I live in West Bend. And several days ago, I took a third gentleman, an elderly gentleman, actually I shouldn't say elderly, two years younger than my youngest son, took him to the hospital on the brink of death, which he still is. I don't know if he's going to survive or not. Yesterday, when I was going through my videos, I was sitting waiting for something, I realized, oh my gosh, I have this guy on video when I first got here in the first few days. Happy, cheerful, enjoying life, and obviously not mentally well, but nevertheless happy. And Amir currently is in mere shadow of himself. He's been in mental health patient since he was 18. So when I finally got his name and got connected with services, he was black from his eyes down. He had had the crap beat out of him. He is emaciated like somebody who lives in Auschwitz. I've never seen anything like it in my life. And of course, we're still not sure if he's going to live or die. And of course, I attribute that to the tent ban. And I understand that you've got a problem here, and I completely support your desire to get homeless people in some away from us. MRSA is running rampant through that community. There is feces on the street. before I go to the place I stay while I'm here in Salem, I go to Planet Fitness, completely change my clothes, put everything I'm wearing in a plastic bag, change my shoes, use the red light booth, try to sterilize myself.
Do you have a request for this group before you stop?
Please stop persecuting these people, and let's find a way to help them. Number one, your social services need to answer their phone every time. We've done it in the state of Washington for years. I know it can be done, and I can explain exactly how to do it. There are a lot of little things that I noticed about the availability of social services that could easily be tweaked. It's simply a matter of policy change that would make a world of difference to the care that these people receive, and they do need care. Right here, it says, it's the City of Salem's policy to ensure that no person shall be discriminated against on the grounds of age, mental or physical disability, etc. and so forth, which is what is happening. These people are mentally ill. I don't know a single person I have met around this area that I could say does not suffer from mental health issues, even the newbies.
Thank you. All right. I imagine we will be continuing to discuss homelessness issues today and for some time, and thank you for addressing us. So we'll move on to action items right now, and the first thing is election of officers.
I nominate Aaron to continue as chair.
I would second that.
I nominate Josh to be vice.
I thought you were vice.
I am, but I'm done.
I second that.
I just know in terms of the vice going into that, I'm still just not at a spot with Enlightened right now where I feel comfortable that I could even potentially go into that role. So I just want to make sure in terms of the, trajectory, that we'll have someone ready to jump into that. So that's kind of my concern.
So it's not because of working with me on the public.
No, I love meeting with you. Okay. I have a great time. See, I don't know if you have a great time, but I do.
Yeah.
See, look at you guys.
I love it.
Question. What is the term then? What is?
A year.
It's just 1 year.
Oh, it's just ear to ear?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Am I supposed to say something?
Nobody's here. I second
the nominee. No, Linda, I did. I did quickly.
Because you're going to be next.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I'd be honored to be in that position.
Thank you.
Yeah. I need your help.
Okay. I mean, I'll still be here. I just don't, the idea of like, okay, well, vice chair needs to go, I'm like, I'm not ready.
Okay.
I'd be honored to serve again, but definitely if anyone else would wish to or would like to nominate anyone else before we...
to go ahead and let's vote. Yes, Aaron's okay.
Call the question.
Okay. All of the above.
Okay, should we do two separate motions or is it just one? Okay. So the motion is for myself, Aaron Turpinning, to be chair and Joshua Kay, vice chair. All those in favor?
Aye.
And opposed? All right, thanks everybody. And that's it for action items. Information reports, city's proposal to increase revenue.
Kristen Rutherford, your urban development director, and I brought in the chief with me to help answer any questions about the public safety part of the revenue package that's proposed. Try to do this without coughing on you too much here.
It's that time of year.
So, yeah. Was there anybody in the room on this board that served on the revenue task force that was convened a year ago? Okay. So, coming out of our strategic planning process and identifying in our budget process and our forecasting and establishing that we have this ongoing gap year after year that has required we dip into our capital reserves to keep our budget whole. The council convened a task force to look at various revenue options and ways to kind of address that gap. Because year after year, our expenses are exceeding our revenues. We have to go into our capital reserves. You can only do that for so long before you don't have capital reserves left anymore. And we are getting closer and closer to that point. So we have kind of a systemic issue there. And a lot of that goes back to, but property tax issues back in the 90s. So with ballot measures 5 and ballot measures 50, and that took away the local control, that county control is the control to establish what you need for property tax revenues to meet your needs. So we're those, that growth is capped at 3% a year. Unfortunately, inflation and expenses, it does not get capped at 3% a year. And so year after year, you know, it diverges. And that's led to the situation that we're in right now. So right now we have about a $16.2 million gap that is needed to continue to provide for our essential city services. And those are things like our firefighters, our police fighters, library hours, parks maintenance, so all those different departments that rely on general fund revenues. That task force came up with two primary recommendations that council decided to pursue. The first one is an operations fee, and that went into effect in January. And that operational fee revenue is basically to kind of fill the main gap. It keeps us doing what we're doing. It doesn't add anything new. So it's just to keep us kind of running even and keep the train on the tracks. And for those that are paying the fee, for single family homes, they're going to pay $8 a month. Multifamily is at $640 a month. Public and commercial and institutional accounts are at $3,856 a month. And there are programs, utility rate relief programs for those that qualify. So that revenue, you know, keep that's in place now, and that will keep things moving forward. The second item, and this will go to the voters in May, yes.
Sorry, this is maybe minutia, but is it $6.40 per unit in the multifamily?
Or is for each
dwelling
connection.
Okay.
Each
service
their
connection.
Utility accounts. Okay. So any utility account.
Got it.
That's not by the city or any utility account?
These are our water sewer utility counts.
And another question.
Not your electric garbage.
Another question, Kristen. But it says as soon as February 2020, but you're saying it's already.
It went into effect in
you'll see it in your February.
It'll show up on
your
water
bill.
Okay, I see.
So it will be on the water bill.
Right.
Yes, it'll show up on your water utility bill for the city.
Thanks.
Yes.
Thank you.
Then the second one is the employee paid payroll tax, and that goes out to the voters in May of this year. And that is essentially designed to get financial contributions from those that maybe receive services in the city but don't live in the city. So we have a lot of employees. We have 60,000 commuters that come into the city that use city resources, that use police, use fire, but don't contribute to the system. Hmm. They don't support that system. So the employee paid payroll tax is designed to kind of make the cost for those services more equitable across the board for those that live in the city and those that use services that don't pay for those services. That will be a tax on the employee's payroll, not on the employer. And that is structured so that if you are a minimum wage employee, you don't pay anything. If you earn up to $15 an hour, minimum wage to 15, you're gonna pay 0.266%. If you earn $50,000 a year, you'll pay 0.39%, and retirement income is not taxed. And I'm going to hand it to you to talk a little bit about what those funds will be used for.
Sure.
May I ask one question? Mm-hmm. So are the employers going to identify the employees that live outside of the area, or is this
it's for all everybody? Employees in the city, regardless of where you live. If you work in a city, you're an employee in the city, you pay. If you're self-employed, we don't have a way to track or collect that. If you live off of investments, we don't have a way to collect or track that.
And at this point, do you have an idea if this will pass?
We don't yet, no.
You said a person working in Salem earning $50,000 annually would pay $195 per year. Is that $50,000 plus, or are you just giving an example of? Whereas, like, if you get $100,000, then it's
$50,000.
Oh, okay.
It's roughly $200 for every $50,000.
Yeah.
You make?
Right. Right. No.
It's
saying
the percentage. Right. So if you're at that $50,000.
Yeah.
Or higher level, you'll pay 0.39%.
Right.
If you're $15 an hour up to $50,000 a year, is a 0.266.
Right. Okay.
So, let's talk about what those funds would be used for. And
yes, thank you.
Well, thank you for having me here. I think everybody knows me. If you don't, I'm very more on the difficulties. I'll introduce myself as the one who's a lifelong Salem resident. I think I know more than everybody in this room. I've always been around with these guys. You're helping me build this building. So, if you've been by Masonry Grill, I used to run around that building when I was 5 years old because my father owned it. He owned a commercial business supply and was a chamber president. He was very involved in downtown businesses years ago. So I certainly have a connection to this room because through him, and then I worked for him. So. I appreciate it. For the last 40 years, I've worked for the police department. For the last 14, I've been the chief of police. And it's a wonderful job, but it's certainly a challenging job, as you may guess, with all the issues that are going on today. And I will just use our department as a little example. The payroll tax is designed to facilitate and assist with the public safety needs of this community. That includes police, fire, park ranger, code enforcement, and I believe the courts may be in there, but I'm not sure. And it's designed to, as the operating fee tries to keep us stable, the payroll tax is designed to hopefully increase our abilities to keep up with the community, which we haven't been able to do. And I'll just give you a few examples. In the last 10 years, I think the population of Salem has grown at least 5%. Our crime rate has gone up about 22%. Our response time has gone up to part one major calls has gone up over 3 minutes for police response. And I actually have three less officers than I had 10 years ago. So in the times that we see with the social issues, this lady talked about the homeless issues. I can't tell you how much time we are required to spend on those issues, which really are not police issues or fire issues. Homelessness is not a crime, yet we are placed in a position where no one else has, there's no one else to call. So we get involved in those things. Fire, from the fire standpoint, life and safety, not only in fires, but in medical calls, is an issue for the fire department. And they, of course, response time is critical for them. Because if the chief was here, he could tell you a lot better than I can, but seconds count if someone's having a heart attack or someone's in a medical emergency. And so they struggle to meet those needs. Code enforcement, of course, plays an integral part in a community because they deal with the nuisance type issues, if you would, the houses that aren't kept up, the health issues of many of those things. And so they're an important part of this. And of course, we have one park ranger, certainly like that, and our courts are busy as well. So. So that is what it is designed for, and I will, as I always do, I will just give you real world talk, which is I'm probably somewhat famous for. You asked a question if it's going to pass. We have no idea. I think it's safe to say a community can get, what do they call it, budget weary or something, and I know that is something that occurs in Salem. You were kind enough to pass a police facility bond, a library improvement bond, an $82 million, I believe, school bond. And so I understand voter fatigue and fatigue like that can certainly, 62, 82, I don't know what it was, but we recognize that. But our interest in being here today is just to educate you on the needs of what is going on in the city. And I tell you that the city is not keeping up with the demands for what a community this size needs. I think we get $71 million in property tax, and police and fire themselves cost $87 million. So there are gaps, and these both the operating fee and the payroll tax is designed to try and provide us some of the ability to provide the services that you all have come to expect from the city of Salem, especially public service.
At this point, do you have any idea, like, without getting into too much detail, what you would do if it passed? Like, specifically, is it adding one officer? Is it?
That's of course up to council, where they would put that money. We're trying to be definitive that it is public safety designed, so that it's policemen, it's firefighters, policewomen, policemen, firefighters, and of course they need. There's some things they do need. We need technology assistance, so there would be some of that. Obviously, we have to hire people, so there'd be an HR role in that. But the majority of it would go to police and fire. I think it would equate to, as an example, 20 additional firefighters. I think another engine company or station for the police, for the fire department, additional code enforcement, maybe some more park rangers and such. But I tell you that as examples because it's not up to me to decide on how money spent. It's up to city council. But I think those are some of the examples that we provided in the past.
So there are two pieces of misinformation relating to this that I keep seeing on social media or hearing about. One is tied to the construction of the police station. But the only reason we need this is because we're building a new police station and it's gone over budget. And I know most of the folks in this room know that's not the case, that those additional funds for the police station are not coming from the general fund and have not had any impact at all on the general fund, because urban renewal has contributed to that project and has helped address some of these cost increases. And the cost increases have nothing to do with things that are added to the building. It all has to do with the construction climate that we're in and construction projects everywhere, because of materials, because of labor shortages, you know, the prices are just going up and up and up. So things that are beyond our control.
And I would add to that, and I don't want to sound defensive here. I hear those rumors, or those comments too, but not rumors, but comments. A lot of people think, oh, just give me, it's been our position. And we've actually, as Aaron knows, we cut about 10% off of that building after voter approval. It started at 115,000 square feet, and it's more when it will be completed. So we, as a team, CB2 and DLR and ourselves, recognize this is going to cost more than we thought. And so we actually reduced the size of the building as well. I don't want you to think that we just tried to hammer it, but that sounds really defensive, so I apologize.
And then one of the other comments and pieces of misinformation that I've been hearing about have to do with an intern project that I had an intern do last year. And that was to look at all of the city departments and the amount of staff time that is being spent addressing issues around homelessness. Police response, fire response, parks crews, those that worked out in our stormwater facilities and that clean up, you know, abandoned camps, cleaning services, you know, town, all of that, to find out. We took a snapshot of time, and she got staff hours during that period of time, and then we extrapolated that to an annual expense to find out how much of our staff time is not being spent doing the things that we would normally be doing, but is getting diverted to address this issue, so that we would have a baseline, so that as we invest in either additional housing, additional services, all of these things, that we have that baseline to see if that situation is improving or not improving. So we'd never done that sort of assessment before. So I had an opportunity a year ago to have an intern from Willamette University do that work and work with all of our different departments to establish that baseline. And then we attached, there was a number attached to that. And that ended up in the press this fall. And there are a lot of people in the community that think that this is additional money that we're spending on addressing those services, and that that's just something we could cut from the budget. And that's not the case. This is not additional money. This is for the money being spent on our base operations. And rather than maybe for the stormwater folks, instead of doing any sort of like stream restoration or enhancement or testing, things that they should be doing, it's the hours that they're spending picking up needles and human waste and trash and hauling that out. So it's more about the use or diversion of resources, not resources that we could cut or eliminate. So that's, you know, something else that you may hear out there, that, you know, why does the city need to do that? There's $5 million they could just cut right there to not deal with homeless issues that would save money. And again, it's not the case. It's not adding funds in the budget. If police staff are responding to individuals who may be homeless, it doesn't mean we can do away with that police staff. It just gives them the capacity to deal with other issues and respond to other calls.
Well, and I think our response time is probably a perfect example of that. If our officers are tied up on any sort of issue, then they're not free to go do something else. So, in other words, if we're spending an inordinate amount of time on people with mental health issues, for instance, we're not doing something else that this community has asked us to do. So it's a diversion. It's a diversion of what this committee has asked us to do. And quite frankly, the homeless issues is a huge diversion.
This might become a good transition into homeless, unless you have questions about the revenue piece.
This is just to appease my interest, I guess. I haven't read any of the measures that are affecting the payroll tax. I'll firmly support the concept of cost sharing, and for those of us commuting to Salem, certainly should help carry our weight. My gut feeling is this is raising revenue that supports the general fund and doesn't necessarily represent an increase in funding, money protection of the existing funding for the public safety function of the city of Salem today. It may keep them at their current level or maybe a little bit, and frees up other general funds to deal with things such as perhaps the housing assistance program or whatever. Is that a fair assumption, or am I off base?
I think the payroll tax revenue would be designed specifically for additional public safety things. It doesn't mean, I can't think of the word, where you bring the money in here and then you siphon it off from the bottom.
Right. Yeah. Like the laundry fund. Yeah. Yeah. That's where it's expected from.
No, it is not designed for that. In fact, if it were to pass, I would certainly hope this community would see a change in our ability to provide public safety services.
So the intent is for there to be a total additional net of revenue for public safety.
On top of the budget.
Not to leave it either, not to add more here and take some away there.
Totally unrelated to this subject, but I just want to take a moment to thank every officer in the police force, are great guys. Kevin Hill's group, the downtown enforcement, are super.
Thank you.
Yep. I agree.
Thank you.
I agree.
So is the, as the bond language is written, and as we'll see it on the ballot, it will say something like these funds can only be used for public safety issue or
Yeah. Say something like that.
It'll be written some, I don't have the exact questions, but I think it is going to be written to limit it to public.
It has to be descriptive enough.
Yeah.
Exactly what the funds are being used for.
Yeah, that was, I mean, even just in terms of the title of it, is that necessarily the title, or could it be something like public safety payroll tax, so that it's very clear from the title what it's for?
I don't know how they're putting it in the title, but I think in the description, that specifically limited to public safety.
Right, so I'm just saying it seems a missed opportunity if we don't.
So titles they're limited to how long titles can
okay.
be.
Okay, yeah.
So that might be part of the reason.
Okay.
Yes?
If it doesn't pass, are there any contingency thoughts on how funds would be raised? Would you try it again at another?
That would be up to council, and I don't really answer. There is no contingency plan right now, other than we will have to. We'll have to deal with how much money we have, and we have to see what we could continue to afford. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Kristen, hold on, let me go back to it. Oh, this is what it was. Is there some kind of like infographic that can be easily shared, on Facebook, these kinds of things that, have general fund and then, this is what that goes to. This is just an easy thing. And then, this bond fund does to that so that when people are being like, no, it's just going to go to that, we can just easily send that picture and be like, no. And we don't have to talk to anyone, we just send a picture.
So that we're talking about the police bond went?
Yeah, like, I don't know, I was just thinking like some kind of chart that had like, these are our funds of the city, and this is what that fund gives to, or that bond gives to, so that it's very clear for anyone who...
Visually clear.
Visually clear, yeah. Thank you.
I think that may exist on our website.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. We'll find out before this meeting's over.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we've got one that takes it to the different bonds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have information on different funds.
Mm-hmm.
But let me look into that.
It just, again, we have a community... Well,
yeah.
I think we're a society of... not looking into things and not and just wanting to, so if there's an easy way to share information without having to have a full-on discussion about why I know this and why you know that,
mm-hmm.
it's just like, from the city, this is what it says. If you want to talk about that, but it's very clear, this is where the money goes.
The other thing is if, like on the facility, if it said, here's the police facility bond.
Right.
And it showed the sources that was paying for the police facility. Then when somebody says, oh, you're doing this because you need money, it doesn't have a gap.
That's
basically,
it
says the bond is $62 million. URA is contributing this. It matches the total. So there is no... We need to do this because the police facility went over budget and now it shows this is the cost, this is the sources, you're done.
And it's like you can get more information online or whatever, but this is just a one page that,
that information, that
is there.
We had that shared that with council at the time that we were making the urban renewal budget share allocation to the project. And that's certainly something that could be promoted and shared,
mm-hmm.
but once people start talking about things, it kind of takes on a truth and life of its own.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There is a great deal of information on the website. I don't know if it is exactly what you're saying, but there's a calculator on there where you can put in how much money you earn and it'll tell you what your taxes would be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty educational. We did the same thing with when a police facility if your property is worth so much money, it would tell you how much you would pay in taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So that does exist. And if you just thumb through that might help, isn't it?
Yeah, that's fine. Again, this is more for people that aren't going to do that kind of stuff and just want to see a picture. It's just the one, people like us that understand from the 10, but you got to get the, if we want this to pass, you have to get the general public that is on payroll to feel like, yes, we need this.
Most people, quite frankly, or a lot of people, don't understand city government.
Right.
We always get asked about our city buses. Well, we don't have city buses.
Right.
It's completely different.
Exactly.
But I would bet you a huge portion of the population thinks the charities are a city of Salem. In fact, some of you in this room may have thought that until I just said that. And you make a really good point about education. That's really what this is about. Mm-hmm. And I would hope, and I think the big purpose of us being here today is to educate you about what it's about. I don't ask you to advocate for it. That is your own decision. But what I would tell you is, if people ask you about it, you at least can inform them correctly about what we talked about today, or refer them to the website where they can get factual information versus, as Kristen said, rumor.
Chief Moore, you said that you had 3 less officers than you had 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like we're understaffed to handle the public safety needs now. Do you think that's strictly due to the budget, or is that due to a lack of interest from people wanting to pursue that career?
We can fill as many positions as we have. We can fill them. In the last 5 years or 6 years, we've probably filled over half of our department. As some of us age out, we're a younger department. I would attribute it to funding capability. Now, I said this publicly once before, I may not have represented my organization well enough, because for the last 10 years, I know we've needed additional resources, but I didn't bring it up because I knew the budget couldn't facilitate it. So bad on me, and here we are. But last year's budget, I said, I need 11 more police officers just to keep pace. And quite frankly, that went nowhere because there was no money. And I knew when I asked for it, there was no money. So I think it's more of a budgetary question.
So I guess one comment and then a question. And thanks for providing the resources. Mm-hmm. The comment is, I guess combating misinformation is almost a full-time job with the city of Salem.
Right.
And you talk about, you know, it's almost like it's a very sensitive political, yeah.
Yes.
But you talk about diversion of resources. So I'm with Vincenzo as far as educating people and making it user-friendly. Like, this is great. Like, if I wanted to go on this website, I could say, how did we get here? What is the city's financial shortfall? And get informed. But I guess it's a marketing initiative to educate
right.
people.
And that was the other kind of part of it. It's like, are we going to put money into marketing?
Yeah.
To then, I mean, because you have to, but what does that look like budgetarily?
Yeah,
so that is, that's a challenge for a public agency
right.
when it comes to ballot measure,
right.
because
right.
we cannot advocate
right.
for it. Oh. Once the ballot
right.
measure is out there,
mm-hmm.
we can provide factual information on our website to educate, but we have to be extremely careful that it doesn't come across as promotional or advocacy in any way.
We, when we did the police facility, I'll give you a quick example. We had, we lost the first one, it was very close, and we came back for a second one, but a several community leaders, I would call them, that you all know, stepped up and said, we need to pass this, and they created a political action committee that was separate from the city of Salem, and they ran the campaign, for lack of a better term, because, you know, there was some, you probably, if you remember that time, and hopefully you've wiped it from your memory, I was on TV commercials all day long, and no matter what channel you went to, so I apologize. But there were questions about ethics, and quite frankly, anytime the city did something, we ran it to the State Board of Ethics to make sure that we were doing it right, which is exactly what Chris was talking about. I could provide facts. I couldn't say, would you please vote for this?
Uh-huh.
But a PAC can do that. And And as you may guess, there are lots of friends of police and fire in this community that would step up and create a pack. We haven't probably located those individuals that want to step up and be a pack for more taxes, just to pay for services. So if any of you are interested, give me a call and I'll set you up.
And then I guess just my actual question was on where did these revenue options come from? So my understanding is this is pretty common practice in other cities, right? Is that where this comes from?
These kinds of fees?
Yes.
The employee payroll tax is, I would say, not a really common tool used right now in a lot of communities, but there are communities that use it. And the fees in general, more and more communities over the last decade have been turning towards these kinds of fees. Whether they're parks fees, public safety fees, special public street fees, as ways to continue to provide services with property tax gaps widening.
Okay.
So,
there's 50 cities in Oregon that have an operating fee adjustment bill. Eugene is the only one that I know of that has a payroll tax, and they are utilizing that strictly for police, I believe. And they're going to hire about 60 officers. And they are the same size as us. So in a couple of years, two identical cities will have police forces that have a 60-officer gap.
Wow.
Between the two of them.
And their property tax revenue is quite a bit higher than ours. Well, they bring in a lot more property tax.
Well, I would say thank you very much for your service. Thank you very much for the efforts in this. As a business owner and a financial institution, we greatly appreciate knowing that you're there and would love to have those response times be as quick as possible. As an employer of over 60 employees in downtown, we would love to see those services expand in whatever way we can help support. My only question, I guess, in the content of some of this is from a financial standpoint, there's a lot of talk of revenue, but not necessarily a ton of talk about expense, and that's where, from a business standpoint, if you're managing something like that, which, again, this, like you talked about, some of this general fund stuff that obviously creates some of this issue, but I don't know if it's the marketing agenda side of it or what, but is there other information out there that guides, because I haven't seen click the links on any of it, but is there information that talks about the expenditure side? Mm-hmm. Obviously, you addressed your side of doing the analysis on the one component, if it was factored out, but in general, is there other information out there on what's being done or promoted to cut some expenditures to help in general on all this?
That one, we're in really, I'd say, a very difficult position right now with further cuts, because over the years there have been really deep, significant cuts. As Chief mentioned, yes, fewer officers now than we did 10 years ago. That's because of cuts that have happened over time. And that's not just police, that is every city department is either, you know, fewer staff or much more work with the staff that we have. And we haven't focused on that because I think across the board our leadership team is of the opinion that we can't cut more. We have cut and cut and cut so much over the years that we cannot continue to provide services that we provide. I mean, we're at a point now where then we would be cutting services.
Yeah.
That's the only place that we can identify, whether it's cutting park services, library services, or, you know, those other big pieces of the general fund.
So you truly identify it as a revenue problem,
yes,
not an expense.
Yes, yes.
So I can see where it comes from.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks for being here and
thank you very
informing
much.
Us.
Should you want to switch back to the homelessness?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, about Kevin Hill's team, the downtown team, you know, when I was talking about the diversion of resources, just to go into that a little bit more as a really good example of how that works is
the cleanups that we did about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, downtown, in front of Salem Center and the Rite Aid building, from where those new encampments are. So we've been monitoring those from, you know, public health, public safety perspective, and we contracted for services to bring in a company, close down the sidewalks, move people out for the day, do some cleaning, sanitize things. So that sort of a process involves the police team, downtown team, to go out and provide notification and to be there to provide assistance to help move people out of the area. We had our housing authority staff, our HRAP case managers out there to offer services, provide services. We brought in the nonprofit, so a staff time to coordinate all of that to get folks down there to do that outreach. And then public works staff to close everything down, to manage that project. You know, so
what would the what kind of services would HRAP have offered?
So
what's HRAP?
HRAP is the Housing Rental Assistance Program, and that is a program that was established in our third year of this now. And this is funding. We have about $700,000 budgeted this year. We started with $1.4 million the first couple of years, and that was to provide housing to the 100 hardest to house individuals in the homeless community. So we have a coordinated entry system that was established a few years ago, where homeless individuals can go through a community action agency to get assessed, and they go through an in-depth interview and scoring procedure. And those, the scoring kind of is tied to physical health, mental health, how long they've been homeless, you know, those sorts of challenges. And the higher you are on that scale, and the harder you are to house. Maybe it's a criminal history combined with some of these other issues. And so these funds were dedicated to target those individuals that have the most barriers to housing and that are the least likely to get there on their own. And they're provided with case management services through our housing authority and through the Community Action Agency. The police work very closely with them to get them into housing, to get them stabilized, and then eventually transition to a Section 8 voucher where they can sort of self-sustain long-term in housing.
So when you say they were offered, someone from HRAP was there saying,
yes,
can we take you into the program?
Are you interested in the program?
Okay.
Or other services?
Okay.
You know, do you need clothing? Do you need medical care? Are there other things that you need where we can connect you with those providers? So they were out there 2 days in each of those, 1 day in each location. They had one person per day in each location that were interested in services. All the other folks that they talked with out there were not interested. Same group of people, same team was out at the state capitol when the state police and state parks were removing people from the state capitol. Again, I think we have one person that was interested in services. So it is not uncommon with this population that we see downtown that when these outreach attempts are made, that people are receptive to.
So that was three people out of roughly how many? Do you have any idea?
There was 80 people I counted by Nordstrom's.
Okay.
And not as many by Rite Aid.
And there were maybe 20 to 30 up around the state capitol.
So maybe 100. 20 people?
The state capitol was the same people that were
down.
Okay. So maybe
and it's the same people that were over by Arches.
Somewhere between 80 and 100 people, roughly.
Today, just to interrupt, because I can do that, I guess. my personal on-site census is there's 700 at the canopy at Macy's before they open this morning on private property.
Yeah.
I probably don't have an active TLC either, but it's up to Macy's to deal with. Two on Center Street North, which is the same side as Ross. 14 at Center Street South, which is essentially from the fence to my High Street entrance. And there's probably close to 40-something on Rite Aid. And every one of these individuals, I don't talk on the Lucas Street group of Rite Aid because they're interesting characters, but every other one of them do not desire sheltering or other services. I just wanted to reemphasize the point that you made regarding that. They are simply not interested.
Yep. And it's a big challenge.
There's always, people are welcome to have other opinions. I'm just saying, those that I've talked to, and I've talked to almost every one of them out there on the seat, block bases on adjacent to the center, they do not desire services.
So, you know, it's, for a lot of the folks in the community, it takes, it might take 90, it might take 100 contacts before you hit them at that day, that time, that moment, when they're ready to say yes. So it's not you offer it once and then that's it. It's an ongoing process.
Trust building process.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of background and history, where we are now. There's a lot of misinformation in the community about that too. So things really kind of, I think, started to steamroll maybe starting August, early September, when the camp that was out on the out of the quarry area out next to Wallace Marine, private property, there was a large camp out there where those property owners went through the process to evict people off of their property. And that broke up that camp and people started migrating to Wallace Marine and then into downtown. At the same time, out at Cascade Gateway, there was a pretty large camp out there, and a lot of the folks out there were in ODOT right-of-way, and ODOT did a cleanup activity out there, removed brushes, they enlisted police support, social services support to remove people from the public right-of-way out there. So that also caused a dispersion throughout the community. And because of those two activities, a lot of folks ended up moving more into the downtown. Cyclically, in the fall, we start to see more people come into the downtown anyway as the river starts to rise and weather gets bad. And we will start to see those individuals that have some of the highest needs, particularly from a mental health perspective, that will move into the downtown and want to be close to services. And that population and largely is here year-round, to be close to services, and because it's safer, because there's more visibility, more people around, better lighting, all of that. So a lot of those folks ended up starting to camp around Arches and across the street from Arches, just at the north end of downtown. And it, you know, started with just a couple tents and then grew to what it was before that cleanup occurred. So at the time, looking kind of the November, early December time frame, we were monitoring that from a number of different perspectives, including the public safety, health and sanitation perspective. Code enforcement was going out there regularly to look at conditions, was getting very close to addressing the issues based on the public health side of things. And then in early December, that's when council took action on the ordinance relating to camping, and then that also had the sit light and the abandoned property components to it. They did not enact the sit light portion, but they did enact the camping and the abandoned property pieces. And that was with direction to come back to council with recommendations for an organized campsite somewhere in the community the following week. So from one meeting to a meeting from the 2nd to the 9th, I think those were dates, staff did research on a number of different locations around the community, different parks or publicly owned property, where we could establish a sanctioned campsite. And the staff recommendation was that if we are going to do a sanctioned campsite, that the only way we should do it would be to have it be a managed campsite, because that has been the best practice around the country. Sanctioned campsites that are not managed turn out to be nightmares in the community. They end up being their public health and sanitation issues, and there are victimization issues, because you end up with basically the biggest, baddest person in that group that kind of runs the show. And they end up with victimization and other criminal issues that go on there. They are incredibly expensive to clean up after things get really, really bad and then people are moved out. So there's that challenge as well. And so
So we advise that if the city were to go down this path, our recommendation is do it in a managed capacity. To do it in a managed capacity, you need a manager, a nonprofit partner to do that. There are costs associated with that, and it would take time to get that party on board, get the camp set up, and have it run properly. And that was going to be about 60 to 90 days. And at that time, we don't take comments during this period. The Arches was interested in serving in that management capacity. So just prior to coming back to council with that information, on a Monday, we received information from a community action agency that they had a conversation with one of the churches in the warming shelter network, and that they may be interested in operating a duration shelter model for a 90-day period, rather than just on a weather. So right now, when temperatures are forecasted to be 32 degrees, they activate. This would keep it active for a 90-day period. So they had talked with somebody on the board that they had worked with closely on the warming centers over the years. On a Friday, they provided us with a budget. They shared this with council. Council saw that as being a better and more immediate option than the camping, which was going to take some amount of time to get set up and organized. And would be camping. It wouldn't be in a shelter. So council went ahead and, you know, they passed the camping fees. This direction to go ahead and start moving forward with this duration shelter model, and the camping, the organized camping was sort of taken off the table at that time period. Then the immediate follow-on to that was that the church that we thought would be able to provide this capacity had not vetted this through their board, and they were in the middle of some of their own transitions with the retirement of a pastor and some people coming off their board. And they decided that they were not in a position to make that commitment or to be able to have enough church volunteers and church leadership to run that during the 90 days.
After all of that?
That opportunity did not come to fruition. So that then left us with the enforcement. We're starting to enforce the camping ordinance. The duration shelter isn't going to happen. We start looking for other locations where we could activate the shelter. So I personally, along with Jimmy Jones at Arches, have worked with a broker that Arches works with closely, and we have looked at many, many, many properties within the community that just try to get a shelter space. Our challenges have been that we either have a property owner that is not willing to enter into a short-term lease without a commitment to purchase the property, because they're very concerned about damage that will be done, and I think even more than the damage, because that could all be worked into lease terms. What is going to attract the location, and after the shelters close down, are people still going to be there, you know, and want to stay in that location? Then the other piece is there have been a couple of property owners that would be willing to enter into a short-term lease, but their properties don't meet the life safety from the fire and building perspective without some significant investment. And the time that it would take to do the work and the money that we would have to invest to make it habitable, we kind of missed the window. And so that hasn't made any sense either. And then the other piece with, you know, those property owners that would sell it, enter in short-term lease with a sell, is the locations of those properties are currently zoned where we would have to get a completely changed the zoning to have a permanent operation there in the future. Some parts of the community are zoned where a shelter would be a conditional use. The properties that we found that are viable candidates for a purchase are not. And so Arches would have to commit to a purchase prior to going through the land use process and that change. And that's just a big risk right now to do that in that time frame. And they don't have the funds available today to do that. So those are some of the hurdles that we've come up across.
So the most recent proposal that was made, since all of these privately owned properties have not turned out to be viable, would be to take the one location in the city that would accommodate a shelter from a building and safety perspective and is under city ownership, and that was the Pringle Community Hall building out of Pringle Park. So we, you know, just in the last week, we've had a public meeting where the neighbors could come in and talk about that, and then that also went to council for consideration. And there's a great deal of neighborhood opposition to siting it in that location. So at this point in time, Pringle is not under consideration either. There were concerns that should we activate a shelter there, that it would get used, but it wouldn't really address the issues that we're having downtown. The folks that are downtown, some of them would go there, but it's not likely that a lot of them would go there for a few different reasons, one being the location, and the other being that a lot of the folks that we've got downtown sleeping on our streets, whether they're in tents or not in tents, are not interested in shelter, and they're not interested in housing. They want to be where they are doing what they're doing. We have shelter capacity on many nights at the UGM and in other shelters. I've had our housing authority staff for a week call on a nightly basis all around to all the different shelters to see how many beds or mats are available. And on pretty much every night, there is some space still available. You can't make people go to shelters. We can't. We've looked at the fairgrounds, we've looked at Hillcrest, we've looked at a lot of different locations. At fairgrounds, they're not interested. Hillcrest has a number of operational challenges, including water resources and other things. But even if those did turn out to be viable alternatives, you can't make people go there. You cannot force them to go there. So I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but that's kind of where we are right now with what's going on downtown.
I'll be more happy to add a few things. And what I will say, I love Kristen because she's so politically correct. I will tell you the real world as I see it. Many, and I would say most of the people that are downtown have probably been there for years. They were probably the same people that did occupy Salem, that occupied the spiral staircase, that occupied the area below the Marion Street Bridge, and then frequented Arches, now frequent downtown. And you would think after many, many years of people approaching you and trying to provide service to you that you would move on, but it takes two to tango. And if you don't want services, you're not going to take them. And there's a variety of reasons for that, and I understand it. I've really tried to educate myself on the homeless over the years because I knew I had to deal with the situation. I've heard there's 1,800 homeless people in the Salem area. We don't deal with 1,800 people, I can tell you that. Many of them are somewhere. They find some place to go, they find a relative, they find someone where they can stay. And so we, as a community, deal with the people that are the hardest to house. Variety of reasons for that. Many people are homeless because of things have gone bad in their life. They've lost a job, whatever. I would say the majority of people that are homeless are there because they have worn out their welcome wherever they are, whether that was because of mental illness, because of alcohol use, because of drug use. And because of that, they find themselves in some very difficult situations. And I tell you this, not that I made it up. I've talked to a whole bunch of experts that will tell you the same thing. So I don't want you to sound, I don't want you to think I sound like the most cold-hearted person in the world, but in many cases, we enable this behavior. We bring people coffee, we bring them donuts, we bring them pizza, and then we say, why don't these people move? Well, why should they move? Now, I know that not everyone in this room will agree with everything I'm saying here today, but what I'm saying is our officers, I would venture to say, have offered every single person in the downtown area some sort of service, whether it's HRAP, whether it's our LEAD program, law enforcement assisted diversion, which we've been successful in getting a lot of people out there. HRAP has been successful. But until somebody wants to make a huge difference in their life, I think this is the kind of lifestyle they're going to lead. I agreed with what Jimmy Jones said and Kristen touched on it the other day. We could have 10 camps all over the place, and a variety of these people, or a majority of the people, probably wouldn't go for one simple fact, and that's there's rules.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to follow rules, you're not going to go to one of those camps. And I tell you that, I've talked to people in Eugene, I've talked to people in Portland. I don't make this stuff up. If I did, it would be right to say it publicly. Those are the facts. So these are the most difficult people. There's been a huge suggestion, there have been lots of suggestions that the camping ban was a terrible thing, it was the most cruel thing you could ever do. I understand that, that shelter is critically important. But when there are shelter beds available that people refuse to go to, I don't want to deal with. If we didn't have a camping ban right now, I don't think we have structures downtown. We don't have tents, and we don't have lean-tos, if you will, because our officers say, you can't do that. And they're pretty good at that. There was a comment earlier today that we're persecuting these people. We have not issued one citation since the camping ban went into effect that I'm aware of for someone that's camping. Our officers feel the same way that many people do. It doesn't do us any good to give somebody a ticket that doesn't have any money. It just spirals into a warrant, and then we arrest them, and it makes life worse for those people. So that's kind of where that's at. We have tried to maintain as best we can the ability for people to live without being persecuted. Now, when we tell people you can't be here or whatever, that's not persecution. If somebody is on private property, you can't be there. I've heard more horror stories than you will ever imagine about how people have been impacted by homeless individuals who are alcohol loaded, drug loaded, have mental health issues, threaten people, do all those things. So our challenge here is to try and find enough housing, which where there will never be for many of these individuals, and try to maintain the peace. Now, the last thing I will tell you is this. Just because you are homeless doesn't, in my opinion, this is my opinion, give you the right to negatively impact everybody else around you. And that is the situation we have. There are many advocates for the homeless, and I understand it all. But downtown looks like a landfill. And I mentioned it to some, if you kept things clean and didn't do some of the things you do, people wouldn't complain about you the way they do now. But as long as they continue to do those things, for a variety of reasons, you are all going to be frustrated, and you're going to take that frustration out on us because we can't do anything about it, and we don't have the tools. I was a big advocate I've been a big advocate for 3 years for sit-by ordinance, and people say, where are they going to go? I don't know. I don't know where they're going to go. Maybe they can go wherever they came from. Maybe they can find somebody that can help them. Now, people say, well, that is so stupid that you would say that. If they could do that, they would have already done that. I'm not so sure. That's what I would add.
In the interest of time, it's maybe a brief answer, but if it's like, you know, just having a structure is not going to really solve the problem, especially for the hardest to house, and just policing them and moving them from here to there isn't really going to solve anything, and it seems like having like intense case workers with, you know, however many individuals they're trying to
build a relationship, build trust, move them into better and better situations. Where do you see that, in your opinion? Do you see that coming from the city and the city, you know, passing a bond to fund that? Or do you see it from the service providers out there, nonprofits, the state?
Why don't you talk big picture strategy here a little bit?
Yeah.
You know, kind of how we're coordinating.
I mean, my intent is that I imagine even the DAB may be eventually asked to recommend to council that we allocate some funding to something. And so, you know, with that in mind, that just having a structure somewhere really, it's going to help some people, but not.
There are a number of things that are in play, and that some of these have been in play for a while, and they just haven't come to fruition yet. And other things that are that we're working towards. Okay. So one of the things that has been in the works and under construction is an enhanced day room space down at Arches. That construction project has gone on far longer than any of us anticipated it would go on, especially Cherie. But we are being told that in February that will be open. So that is more space for that can accommodate more people.
Do you have any idea?
I can't tell you like how many more will accommodate, but it is bringing on more restroom facilities, more space inside for people, shower, laundry, kitchen, all of those sorts of things. There is also interest from the governor in establishing a navigation center in Salem, and that would likely be in partnership with the Arches project. And a navigation center usually has some shelter space with it and the supportive services, county mental health, and everything's kind of co-located in one center. So that is something that sort of that we're moving towards. And then we have a number of housing projects that are also in the works. In our North Gateway Urban Renewal Area, we purchased a property in partnership with the Housing Authority, and that is being redeveloped and renovated into 37 units of permanent supportive housing. Six of those units will be available for respite care for folks that have been in the hospital and don't really have a place to go and they need a place to stay for a while. There will be case managers on site. So that project, those units, we're expecting they will be available in May. We also have Yaquina Hall on the North Campus that we entered into a purchase and sell agreement with DAS back in 2016. We still don't have a completed subdivision there yet and are not able to conclude that purchase. We're hoping that we're getting close, but that project, delivering that project, is a good 2 years behind when we thought we would have it. That will be another 52 units of permanent supportive housing, and a percentage of those units will be targeted towards people with serious mental illness and are the kind of units that some of our downtown population are desperately in need of. We also have a property that we own, and we have plans for construction for 75 unit permanent supportive housing development. We don't have funding for that yet, but that's another thing that we're working towards with the Housing Authority. So, and there's some other tools using urban renewal that we're exploring that we're taking to council in a month or so to help use urban renewal as an incentive to get affordable units in mixed unit developments that go anywhere within the city. So we said a lot of things that are in the pipeline, some coming online this spring, others will be a little bit longer term, but the housing piece is key. We are so far behind on what we need for housing at all levels in the community because we just have not been producing it at the rate that people are moving to the West Coast. And that has caused a lot of price increase. And so we have a lot of people that have our Section 8 vouchers through the Housing Authority that can't find a place to live within the income limits. And so they go unused. That adds to the problem. So. It's going to take more than just affordable housing development. It's going to take a lot of market rate housing development as well to kind of start to equalize everything.
I was going to say, one place that I would look, and it's a long-term solution. It's not. Our mental health system is broke. We used to have, and I know institutions is not a popular word, but we used to have people who couldn't take care of themselves in a place where they could be cared for. Today, those same people are out on the streets, and no one can care for them, and they can't care for themselves. And when you talk about humane treatment, there's nothing humane about somebody living or sleeping on a sidewalk all night long because they have no place else to go. When people have mental health issues, they don't take their medications and they have issues, this is where they end up. They become victims of crime, they become victims of, instead of taking the medication that will help them, they self-medicate with alcohol and drugs, and there's nothing good about that. And I've often thought, if I had a child or a friend or a loved one, do I want to put them in an institution? Maybe not. Do I want to instead have them live on the street where they are so vulnerable to all of the issues that you may have heard today, MRSA, drugs, sexual assault, whatever it might be. I think we have to help. I think we have to fix the mental health system. So I would suggest, if you really want to get involved, that you talk with your legislators or look to them for maybe trying to make a difference. If we could take care of that population a little bit better than we do, we wouldn't have the situation we have today.
Is that what is that? Because didn't Catholic Community Services, their whole branch of supporting people with disabilities, mental disabilities, went under a couple years ago, right? And it's that been an influx of this?
I would say that would be a piece of it. There, social service, our mental health providers, you know, we have police officers that drive with mental health professionals now. We have 6 teams in Marion Polk County who do that. And instead of taking people to jail, we try and get them into a better program for them. I would say there's no housing for them, there's no institution for them. We take somebody to treat them, and when they're medically stable or whatever, we put them back on the street, and I think that's what we have to fix.
So
the last thing I would like to address, I'm sorry, Josh, did you have a question first?
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned getting in touch with legislators. Is there a conversation going on between Senator Courtney and...
So not on the mental health side of things. We are having conversations with Senator Courtney about funding for a navigation center and or a low barrier shelter, and some operational funds to get that up and running.
Okay.
And we are also having conversations with the state, Senator Courtney's office, about the Aquinna Hall project, because our gap has grown the longer that this has gone on, and so we're turning to the state to help fill some of that gap so that that project remains viable, because that does have the mental health component to it.
Great.
Yeah. And so the other piece that I wanted to talk about real quickly is a continuum of care. So back around 2011, Salem, Marion Polk County had their own local continuum of care. And these are organizations that are established to receive the funds through HUD that flow then back to social service agencies. And at that time, we were receiving around $1 million a year for the region. For a variety of reasons, that our local continuum of care was disbanded, and we joined what's called the balance of state. So that's all the other counties in the state outside of Clackamas, Multnomah, Lane, and so there are over 30 counties that are in this broader continuum of care. And in the years that we've participated in this larger group, the funding that has come back to Marion and Polk counties has gone from the $1 million level down to around the $600,000 level. So we're getting fewer resources for our region. And we just got approval here in the last month from HUD to withdraw from that regional continuum and turn off my phone and establish a new local continuum. So we're not going to immediately receive more funding, but it does allow us greater autonomy and an opportunity because of the way that HUD system works. That if we perform well, that we can receive more funding directed towards our region. So we've kind of been coming up on the short end of the stick resource-wise
for the last several years at the federal level. And then at the state level, we have as well. We have a number of housing projects over the last decade that, because we're kind of in the shadow of the Portland area, that Salem continues to get overlooked again and again for financial resources like tax credit projects, because there's a lot of funding that will go to the Portland area, then there's quite a bit that will go to the Lane County area, and then funds sort of get sprinkled around the rest of the state. And they're just over and over and over, there's this kind of long history where they don't come here as often. So that's definitely had an impact.
So what I want to do is make sure that you all know we're going to go into our budget discussions. One of the reasons why I wanted Kristen to talk about the homeless piece is that it will touch our discussions on our budget. And I also wanted to remind you that those of us that were involved in the public meeting, you know, the top three items that came out of that were trash, cleaning and maintaining public spaces, and providing safety and security measures. So when we start our parking fund conversations, because remember, urban renewal dollars cannot be used for paying for the operations or the staffing costs for a navigation center. Mm-hmm. They can be used to buy a building or fix a building, but they can't be used for the capacity or the operational cost. Mm-hmm. Parking fund obviously has its limits too, but certainly cleaning, dealing with trash, and we already pay for police out of that fund. So I think those of you that have been on the board a couple of years, this will be the first year where it's going to even be more difficult because we've tried to squeeze out money for reserves, we've tried to squeeze out money for economic promotion or flower basket. I just don't personally see, with everything that I'm hearing and where the priorities are, it's either going to be a really easy budget discussion because it's going to be it's going to be so focused, and there is no money, and so the focus goes right to these priorities. But I appreciate you giving us all that history, Kristen, because we get bits and pieces of stuff, and you have been in it way up, and I just don't think people understand the, when you talk about diversion, just for us in this department, the loss of having access to you because of all the time that you're being pulled to deal with this. I hope nobody thinks that Salem doesn't care, because a lot of time and meetings and trying to bring partners in, hours and hours and hours. And I appreciate you also saying that, because people, when they go to do cleaning and things, there's always somebody has to be a victim or whatever. And even though we ask service providers to come and outreach to people, we can't make them do that. It's like, you know, so that's a piece I don't think was said. So you call somebody and you say, hey, we want to clean this sidewalk. And they say, hey, you know, we just don't have the capacity. We've been down there every day, four times a day. We're not coming down one more time, but yet we want to make sure that we provide that piece when we go in to clean. And I can tell you that I was in shock when they went in to do the cleaning by Nordstrom's and by Rite Aid, those people that were involved with that, what they said, buckets.
You bring up another thing that I want to comment on, Shirley.
Yeah, because needles.
Because we've had a lot of comments from the community that we'll just get porta potties down there. Okay. So our vendors that provide porta potties, based on recent experiences with the use of porta potties, will not provide us with porta potties or service them unless they are in a managed
environment with somebody there to provide the access. Because of what occurs inside, the damage that occurs, the needles that are left behind, the clogged things up, fires that are set, and just the biohazard environment. We also can no longer take our trash from cleanups through our normal trash removal process. It has to go to a biohazard site at an added cost. So it is not as simple as a lot of people in the community think, that, you know, if you just put porta potties, people will stop pooping on the sidewalks. Well, people will still poop on the sidewalks, and we can't get the porta potties. It's not a viable option.
Anyway, I do want
a lot to sit on.
I know we're running late, but I did want to end on a happy note. And Rebecca's here,
yes.
And she's just going to briefly just talk about our relationship with Center 50 Plus and what came out of the grant that we wrote and how we used it.
Yes, exactly. So over the summer, we applied for one of the AARP Community Challenge grants, and we partnered with Center 50 Plus to kind of come up with a project scope, and we were awarded close to almost $18,000. And essentially, they were to activate some underutilized spaces. We were hoping to have them be inside of vacant buildings, kind of get some awareness that there were some issues with coordinating that with property owners. We thought, well, let's activate some underutilized outdoor spaces. It's beautiful, it's Oregon. So we did that July 24th through mid to late September. A total of 25 different classes were put on by Center 50 Plus. 63 total, so some of them were reoccurring. Very well attended. I did the action after action item report, and they were lovely at Center 50 Plus to work with those gals. They had more than 10 volunteers that totaled 130 hours. The age range was anywhere from 2 years old to 86 years old. The median age was 51. They offered a bus service. People took the bus from Center 50 Plus to downtown. We also were encouraging them to utilize our parking structures, and they took a lot of surveys. The vast majority of people were shocked at how easy it was to park in downtown. Hmm. They realized the parking structures were, we had one of the classes, for example, were right up here with JCPenney, our little lot right here, and the instructors were asking where they were parking, and they're like, oh, on the street somewhere over there. They're like, you can park right here, actually. And they didn't realize that. So that was great to talk, create that awareness and that education. More than 778 people attended these classes. They were great. There are 4 different locations. They were at the Farmers Market, Pringle Hall. They had in this kind of plaza area out here, which is their favorite area, actually. And then they had a couple over at the park. And it was amazing. It was a really great project. They got a lot of new members from it. And the coolest thing, I think, is that they have now created an intergenerational committee. Ooh. They realized we need to be bringing in, the 2-year-old and the 86-year-old, and we're getting along quite well. So now they've created this very popular committee, and they're hoping to do it again next year. That was a fun project to do this summer.
What were the classes?
Oh, okay, I'm going to talk about that. So that was what was amazing to me. They thought that if they offered some classes, it would get you to go out into the community.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to teach a Spanish class.
Mm-hmm. And you
go.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. And so after the class, then you need to go to La Margarita, mm-hmm, and try to order, your food.
Okay. So.
And so they did some fun stuff.
Yeah,
cool. Like that. And of course the parking, or getting them down here, was a big, mm-hmm, one of our big goals, because it's all about education,
right,
and the fear, they don't come down here and they don't ride the bus enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so Center 50 Plus was looking at a way to have a destination for them. Here's how you get on the bus.
Nice.
Here's how you go down. Here's,
yeah,
how you get back on the bus. So there's a whole bunch of those kind of behind the scenes,
yeah,
goals that we were hoping we could accomplish in the midst of just come down and, well, Maria from Olson's Florist,
mm-hmm, yeah,
flower arranging class. I mean, she was back here. She's just so generous. It's like, how cute was that?
Great.
So, yeah, there was a lot of different types of classes that they offered. But anyway, we won't keep you, but wanted to end on a higher note.
Okay.
Okay.
February 13th,
our next
meeting.
February 13th.
Okay. Just a passing comment. For those of you who would like to be active in our local governments, the next city council meeting is Monday evening. It's the eye-opening time. It's a what?
Eye-opening.
Eye-opening.
Eye-opening. Yeah.